you. Today I'm talking to Brooke Warner, and I can speak a little bit about what you do in terms of becoming familiar with your website and your work. Although I would just love you to tell the audience and our viewers about what you do, because I think firsthand is better told than secondhand.
Right. I wear a few hats. So I have a publishing company, She Writes Press, and I'm busy with that, helping women authors to have their voices heard. And so the mission behind She Writes Press is basically to publish women authors. And we have a non-traditional business model, which is great in that it really allows us to focus on the content of the author's work and not only on the brand, because right now publishing is so platform driven, and by which I mean author platform, like you kind of have to have a name or be known. And so we came up with an idea, my colleague and I who co-founded She Writes Press, to have a press that was really more about just focusing on women's voices. And so that has been going on for about 5 years and keeps me very busy. And then in addition to that, I teach memoir. Specifically, I teach a 6-month class called Write Your Memoir in 6 Months. And we do a lot of programming. My co-leader, Linda Joy Myers, and I do a lot of other kinds of classes. We teach bestseller classes, which means that we focus on a particular memoir bestseller and we teach why it was successful. Our long course is obviously intensive and long, but it's really geared toward helping people complete as much of a memoir as they can in 6 months. And then we do in-person stuff. And then in addition to that, I also am a writing coach. So I take on clients, I help people get published, finish their manuscripts. So I have a lot of different irons in the fire.
You really do. That's a lot. How do you do it? Do you get up super early in the morning?
I definitely have probably pretty good time management skills. I do have a little boy. He's 6. And so he keeps me balanced for sure. Because when his day starts, I have to get him ready and he comes home from school and we're together. But I do work a lot. You know, I work before he wakes up. I work after he goes to bed. And I also, I also think I'm a pretty efficient worker, but it's busy.
So my curiosity, and I'm sure with the viewers as well, definitely with the coaching and the work that you do, especially around coaching with the memoir,
Right.
6 months, that sounds, for me as a writer and also working on my memoir, that definitely sounds like that's the course that I need to do. And especially with the idea of writing it and getting it done in 6 months. I mean, obviously, that book, I'm imagining the bulk, and then there can be the first draft and then the revision. But I tend to feel that for a lot of writers, or I should just say for myself, speak for myself, that there's a way that we can keep our projects going and going.
Right.
So how do you address that with the people, with the writers that you work with?
It's a balance, because you also can't force it. So I absolutely think a lot of people come to me, come to our class because they want accountability. They want to finish something that maybe they've been longing to do or that they've been working on for a really long time. It's very difficult to write a memoir in isolation. And for a lot of our students, they don't have the support of friends and family, or maybe they do, but it's a kind of support that's like, oh, that little pet project you're working on, or I don't really understand why you need to spend so much time on that thing, or worse, are you still working on that? If it's been 5-6 years, and I think outsiders don't really understand what it takes, not just learning to write a memoir, but the emotional drain that it can sometimes be on a writer. And so I think what Linda Joy and I do well is that we give space for what needs to unfold for writers, but we also have a kind of rigorous support system within this 6-month class that is really about accountability and meeting goals. But we're careful, you know, not to push people so hard that they recoil in resistance, because you can get to a place where you're so motivated that you're bumping up against other kinds of problems. And so it's a dance, and that's something that we have to hold as teachers and coaches.
There was all of what you said. I was listening to the overall framework, but there was a couple of pieces that you said that resonated in terms of the emotional part.
Right.
And I think with writing in general, it can be emotional, whether you're writing creative fiction in terms of a novel. If it's, you know, often I think writers pull from their own lives and their experiences with writing fiction. But when you're writing creative nonfiction, especially in memoir writing, There's emotion, there's emotionality, and you're going deep. I feel, as my own experience, you're going deep into the work and you're unlayering and you're unpacking, and you often just get to this part or these emotions that you may not have even known that they were there. So you're addressing that point, and I wonder if you could even go more into that subject and how you work with someone when those feelings are really coming up.
Yeah, I mean, it happens in the context of the class, and it also happens in the context of one-on-one coaching, and it happens with the authors that I'm working with at the press. Memoir in particular, I think, requires a lot of you. And as a coach and a teacher, I'm also pushing my students quite a bit. I'm asking them very difficult questions. We are trying to get them to go deeper and be more honest and authentic. I mean, there's a whole lot of processing that has to go on, and also to break free from, from different things. I mean, some people have a tendency to want to paint themselves in a bad light, and some people have a tendency to want to paint themselves in too good a light. Some people have a tendency to want to protect the people in their lives, and so they don't want to write about them in a negative way. And so trying to find and dig through all that stuff, the authenticity that's at the heart of the memoir, to make it relatable is a huge excavation. And there's a ton of emotion that is wrapped up in all of that. So I think we spend a lot of time, I mean, I do across the board, mostly with my coaching clients and my students, though, giving permission and also being careful to say, you don't push send and then this is published tomorrow. Yeah. Like, we get to have a conversation about this. You get to feel what it feels like to be witnessed. If it scares you to death, that's okay, but you get to make a decision to remove it later. You don't have to publish what's being written. I think all of that exploration is really important for a memoirist to push against, and I use the term the radical edge, which is David White's term.
Okay.
And David White, for those who don't know, is a poet who I admire a lot, but he talks about the radical edge. And for me, the radical edge is pushing up against that place that does make you scared, and not so scared and vulnerable that you put yourself at risk, but scared and vulnerable enough that you challenge yourself to even know how far you can go. And so I think we do come to, I certainly know I come to my coaching and my teaching from a perspective of holding people to a very high standard. And part of that high standard is expecting that they will come to that radical edge with me at some point, at least to just see what their outside boundary really is.
I do appreciate that term, the radical edge. And as a coach myself, one of my clients, she got to a stage in her writing where I was going to suggest, you know, because we've also become friends and we knew her before, but saying, do you have a therapist or do you have someone that you check in with? And I was going to mention that, you know, in our next coaching session. And when I saw her for that next coaching session, she said, I call it my old therapist.
Right.
Because she was definitely getting to that place in her writing where she was going to that radical edge of going to these, you know, these experiences when she was a child and a teenager, that as she's reviewing them as an adult,
right,
she's seeing, wow, that was a lot. That was a lot. And I've also been talking, you're addressing that too, is the authenticity in your writing. And I believe that this is what readers want. They want to read the authentic writing.
Right.
And I feel that it's a piece that readers are consciously or even unconsciously connecting to. You know, they're either connecting to pieces in your story that seem familiar, and if not their own personal story, you're writing, the narrator is writing in such a way that they're able to connect the readers to your personal story.
Right.
And so it's one of the reasons that I'm interested in what you do, and I know that the viewers would be interested in what you do, and I know that there's a number of people who are working on their memoirs, and for viewers and authors to reach out to a coach like you and say, okay, I'm working on my memoir, and I'm sure when you work with people and talk with people, you also know if you're a good fit, and I'm very sure you would say to someone, I'm not sure if I'm the right coach for you, but with a lot of people, it's like, you would be. You know, I was talking to someone recently who's a coach, I interviewed them, and one thing she was saying about coaching is someone has to be coachable.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could speak to that more, because I think it is an interesting piece of being a coach.
I think there's something to be said for synergy between a author or a writer and their coach. It's important that the writer be able to take the feedback, and also that they feel that the coach is honoring their voice. And even if there are suggestions for changes, that those suggestions are aligned with what they want, and that they're not constantly bumping up against someone who is asking for something or wanting something that feels out of alignment. So I think there's a responsibility on the writer's part to trust themselves enough that if they have a really good vibe about the coach, that they're like, okay, great. And that if they don't, they either speak up or consider switching coaches. From my perspective, I think when someone pushes back a lot, sometimes that's just their personality. Yeah. You know, they're contrarian. They need that, you know, and sometimes they want to wrestle it out a little bit, and they need someone who can get in the ring with them. And it's just part of what they need to do to hash out what's there. And then sometimes not, you know, and it's my role, I guess, is to discern where it's coming from, because I don't mind getting in the ring with someone who needs that as part of their process. But if it's coming from a real place of misunderstanding, or we're just really not seeing eye to eye, or someone is fighting against me, right, and basically saying, you know, your feedback doesn't make sense, or it's, you know, then that's not a good fit, because I am always looking to elevate the manuscript. And the questions I ask, while I know sometimes are uncomfortable to authors, are always in the service of making a better book. So if an author has a good boundary and can say, I'm not doing that, or whatever, then usually we can move past it. But if it becomes a thing where there's like real tension in the relationship, then it does need to end. And I've been doing this long enough that that's happened a few times. You know, like I had an author who, this happened to be fiction, so it wasn't memoir, but I really did not like her protagonist. Yeah. And I kept talking to her about it and talking to her about it. And finally I just said, I don't think I can continue to coach you, because you like your protagonist, and she's making odd decisions and doing things that make me uncomfortable, and I don't think I can continue to support you to do the book that you need to do. And so she did go and find a different coach, and it was amicable, but it took a lot, I think, for both of us to come to that point, to be like, this book is going to be better served by someone who likes her protagonist and gets her protagonist. And that certainly could happen in memoir, but it's more personal. Because if I don't like a protagonist, that's the person. And so it's a little, you know, if that's more, you know, that gets a little stickier.
What you just shared was really about you being authentic and in your integrity.
Right.
Rather than sort of covering it up and even pretending that you like the character. It's really the place where you can serve someone well, where you can serve your coaching client well. And with that, I thought there was a video that I watched on your site where you were teaching with Linda Joy Myers and the memoir class, and you read a piece of Linda Joy's memoir, and it's a beautiful piece. And I'm not going to be able to say it as eloquently as you in the moment. What I remember you saying is, you know, reading that and saying, you know, this is very different from a reader reading. Well, you know, when I was 10 and we were in Texas and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I think that is where there's so many memoirs out right now. Maybe there's always been this many memoirs, but to me, this just seems to be many more. I think there's been such an interest from readers to read stories of people's lives. So how to eloquently and poetically pull, like, the memoirs are really becoming literature.
Right.
So would you speak to that more specifically with the memoir coaching?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think memoir is a relatively new genre. I mean, certainly compared to fiction. And so there's not so many books, you know, there's not like a canon of literature on how to do memoir in the way that there is on how to do fiction. And so people who are writing these books about canonizing memoir, in essence, are people who are alive and not even that old, you know, like Mary Carr, for instance, you know, who wrote The Art of Memoir. And I think I interviewed her. And so I know that she said that that book she wrote to really put on the map memoir in a way that fiction is on the map, and that there are books about how to do this. And so because it's a relatively young genre, things are still being solidified, and there is more room, I guess, for not new rules per se, but just the way that things are being done and how things are taught in memoir is still being established in a way that is not true of fiction, because fiction writing has been done a certain way and is very, again, canonized in literature programs all over the country and the world for that matter. And memoir programs, by contrast, in university settings and so forth, are young. And sometimes they're even tacked on to creative nonfiction programs. And in publishing, memoir doesn't even have its own category. It's still part of biography. And memoir is not biography. It is its own genre. And so the world of publishing and books has not even fully catching up to speed with how fast memoir is growing and becoming officialized as its own genre. So I think all of that is context to say that people now expect that memoir will read like fiction, but it's true. And then there's also different craft elements, specifically, in my opinion, reflection. And then what Linda Joy and I teach in our class is what we call takeaway, which is a form of reflection, which is like reflecting back to the reader. It's like a way of mirroring your reader so that your reader is feeling your experience or being invited into your experience in a way that is different from reflection, those two things really don't happen in fiction. You know, you might have a reflective character, but the character in a novel is not required to tell the reader what sense they made of a certain situation. And sometimes they do if it's like a, you know, first person reflective protagonist that sounds a lot like a memoir. But in memoir, these skill sets are required. And so it's an interesting time. I mean, I think it's extremely exciting because I love memoir as a genre. I've loved it for a really long time. And it's in this place where it's like, it's still being explored. And in terms of teaching, there's lots of ways that we're getting to teach about the things that we love and kind of figure it out as we go, because we read tons and tons of memoir, and because I've been publishing memoirs, you know, for almost 15 years now.
I've always enjoyed memoirs. I really mainly read creative nonfiction, and then I was raising children, running businesses, and I thought, no, I don't really have a lot of time. And it was almost like, oh, this feels like an indulgence to read fiction. Where I got into it was, I was like, oh, but there's this, you know, and they were called, you know, biographies, autobiographies, and I'd be like, oh, there's some Hollywood star, although even right now I can't recount if I ever read a Hollywood star, you know, autobiography, but, you know, like I have the Andy Warhol diaries, you know, and sort of reading into those. And it really, I feel like in some ways for me at that time, it was sort of like, oh, this is my dirty little secret. Like, is it okay to read about someone else's life? But the memoir writing has become so good.
Right.
I feel addicted. I just finished a memoir by Moby, the musician. Mm-hmm. I never thought that that would be a memoir that would have appealed to me. But somehow I worked in the music industry. I landed on his website and it said he's releasing this memoir and blah, blah, blah. And on a whim, I ordered it. It arrived. I ordered it so I could pick it up at my local bookstore, because I'm very big about, you know, supporting my
book. Well done, yes.
Yeah. And I could not put it down. Mm. It was a page turner. And just, you know, it was, every page had at least one beautiful, like, poetic line. Mm-hmm. And that reflection. And that's what, when you said that you reflect in your workshops, it is so important, I believe, for the author and the writer to have reflection, because as you mentioned earlier, it's isolating to write a memoir, and I feel that it's isolating to be a writer. You know, I know I'm not a writer that can go and sit in my local coffee shop and do my creative work. It's too distracting.
Right.
So I'm at home, I'm on my own, and it's so, and then I facilitate a women's writing group that I write with a group. But it's so important for me to have that reflection and have that community. And what I sensed from your work is that you're really creating community.
Mm-hmm.
And I first learned about you a couple of years ago. I went to Elizabeth Gilbert's writing workshop.
Oh, you were there. How fun.
I was there. And you were there. Yes. I didn't meet you, but I definitely went out to your booth and checked out what you were doing. And I just thought, this is interesting and incredibly inspiring. So did you say you set up She Writes, but that's been 5 years, or, but you've been.
She Writes Press has been around for 5 years, and SheWrites.com has been around for 8. And so I co-founded She Writes Press with the founder of SheWrites.com, is my friend Kami Wyckoff. And so she founded SheWrites.com while I was still working at Seal Press.
So that's, yeah, just even I really want to say to the viewers to definitely come over to your website.
Thank you.
And have a look at what you're doing, because you have some amazing things on there. So you have different authors, I believe, offering different workshops. And then there's the whole publishing piece that you're doing.
Right.
And could you speak a bit more about some of the authors that have been published for you and the books that specifically you've published?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, we have published a lot of books. I think that to date, over 5 years, we've almost hit 200 books. And so we have, I mean, there are some that are memorable that stand out to me, both for the writing or for the story. You know, one of our longtime, really well-selling memoirs is a book called Uncovered, and the author's name is Leah Lax. And she wrote a story about being in an Orthodox Jewish community and having 8 children, and then realizing at some point, you know, just having kind of like a sexual identity coming to reality moment that she, in fact, was a lesbian and needed to leave her, not only her community, but her family and the being ostracized, you know, that followed that. And it was just such a compelling story, and it hit a zeitgeist, you know, because of this sort of uncovering of certain aspects of this community that are cultish. And so it was just fascinating, and the book has done really, really well. And she's an example of someone who shopped the book around to traditional publishers, and everyone wanted it, and no one felt that they could justify taking it on because they didn't think it would sell well enough. And for us, it sold really well. So, you know, so it's an example of where the publishing industry was not willing or able to take a risk, and we can and we do. Because of the way that our publishing program works, it's author subsidized. They invest in the project for a much higher royalty. And so we have hit a sort of, I would say it's a zeitgeist, because the barriers to entry in publishing are so high that people are not getting published, and yet their books need and deserve to be published. Yeah. And I'll just tell one other story right now that's getting a ton of attention on our current list. It's about to come out in July, which is called The Velveteen Daughter. And it's about the woman who wrote The Velveteen Rabbit and her daughter. And so her daughter, whose name is Pamela Bianco, I believe, was like a world-renowned, famous artist by the time she was a young teenager. And so it's historical fiction, and it's about this mother-daughter, both of them famous in their own right, the mother an author, the daughter an artist, and the daughter had what we would today consider to be something like bipolar or manic depression. And they just have, it's a fascinating story, you know, just a recreation of history. And we do a lot of historical fiction. And it's exciting. Like, this book is just getting a ton of attention. So we'll see how well it does, because it's not out yet. But yeah, we're publishing beautiful, amazing books by very talented women.
As you said, it doesn't seem, you know, it's what I say to people. And, you know, we can have this amazing body of work and struggle for it to be published. And it doesn't mean that it's not an amazing piece of work. But where can you go for it to actually to be appreciated for the story that it is? And like you said, with the memoir of I won't be able to pronounce her. Did you say Leah?
Leah Lax. Yeah,
Leah Lax. That was in the in the Hasidic community, and just how, you know, it's like, how far do we go into the mainstream for the mainstream to say we don't think this is going to sell? Although you know that this project is worth publishing, and it's a story that's important to share.
Right.
Very important to share. And that you courageously, in some ways, like, took this project on, and it was published, and it's been successful.
Right.
So for writers to know, and that's why one of the things I really enjoy, and I have recommended reading in my, in the group, in the writing group that I teach. And I also have, you have to buy this book, you know, it's like the required reading. And my required reading is Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic. And one of the things that, you know, she writes about, and I'm not sure if you were able to read it because it sounds like
I read it, yeah.
I'm sure you did, and I don't want to assume because you're doing a lot of reading. Yeah. But, you know, just to read, you know, just for viewers to know, and especially if they're working on a project, that it really is almost like being an actor or an actress, that you can go to hundreds of auditions and you're talented, but you're not getting chosen for the part. And it doesn't mean that you're not a talented, that you don't have talent, but you're not what they're looking for.
Right.
And, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert is such an example of a writer and author who had sent so many pieces out and was rejected, rejected, rejected. And then suddenly, and she speaks specifically to this piece that she wrote about when she was working as a cook in somewhere like Minnesota. I don't know. She was like working, basically, she said, for all these cowboys. And then one night, one of the cowboys is like, you know, just come out. I'm going to show you some of like the real wilderness. And she went out with him. And they get in, they're in this field and they hear all this noise. And it's a moose. And it's like, it's angry, you know, and he was like, stand still, you know, like you have to stand completely still because it's actually dangerous. So she wrote this piece and sent it off to be published, and the editor wrote back and was like, well, thank you for submitting this, but we're really not interested in anything like this. And she sent it out to other publications and it just got refused. And then somehow she ended up sending it out again, and I think she didn't remember that she had sent it to this one editor, and it was a couple of years later, and then the editor wrote back and was, and said, we love this piece. We're going to publish this piece right now. And so she just speaks to almost like the right, you know, being in the right place at the right time, but just that she said, I have no idea what was going on in this editor's life at the time of rejection. You know, maybe, you know, her cat had died or she was getting divorced or whatever. So I think really what I'm saying with that, and I think as an artist and being creative, that so much has to be about believing in yourself and believing in your own work. And sometimes even that, the going can get tough, I believe, you know, as I'm speaking personally. And that's why I feel that it's really important to have a coach and that it's really important to have a community. And I'd like to know with you, as you're so busy and you're coaching and you're running a publishing company, how do you find time for your own writing and your own creativity?
Good question.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
Right. I wrote a book and published it last June, so I'm coming on a year anniversary of my own last book project. It's kind of shocking that a year has passed because I believe it's a great idea to start picking up and writing again right away. But it's not that easy, and I have been very welcoming of this break because it was a very intense period of time for me to write my book, and I think I wrote it in, it took me over a year, but it was just still like carving out that time, it was always weighing on me. And so when I have a big project like that, it does weigh on me. You know, I have, right now for the past, 5 months, actually, I've been working on my TEDx talk because I'm giving a TEDx talk next in May. And so that's been very similar in a creative capacity, just like my books. And it actually for me is a big stress and always has been because, as much as I love creative expression, trying to carve out that time feels like really taking time for myself. And it all, even though it's creative and there's an end game, there's a piece of it because I think my kid is young and just the context of my relationship and stuff, that it feels selfish. And so I can relate to women that I work with who feel that way, you know, that any time for your creative passions, if it's seen as selfish, is very difficult then, because it's wrapped up in this feeling of like you can never get enough, and taking more, it has this kind of complicated relationship to it. So I do have to schedule my time, and I have to work with prioritizing myself also over my clients. And you know, really feeling like this is something that has to happen. And so I don't think that I have like an easy, smooth relationship with creativity. My own creative process is a lot of wrestling. And it's like, it's connected to a lot of like very adrenalized emotion for me.
What popped into my head was thinking about Virginia Woolf.
Great.
a room of one's own.
Right, know? Right. That part, yes. Right.
And
the writer.
Being the writer. And I was recently told that, you know, I know who told me. Louise DeSalvo.
Mm-hmm. I know her, yeah.
Yeah, and what was her book? Healing, writing as a healing path. I should have it right next to me. And she's a scholar on Virginia Woolf, but she said that Virginia Woolf would go up to her writing room in the morning and then write for several hours, and then she would come down, and her husband Leonard would say, And how was the morning? Did you have a good morning? And if she said, I had a good morning, she may have written one sentence, which was
right, right.
And also thinking of, you know, she was a reasonably prolific writer, and I always think, and she was, not that she necessarily had the easiest life, but she didn't have children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had a cook. She had a housekeeper for most of the time.
Right.
And so I'm saying that because as women, yes, as men, but I feel as women, we often have many more things on our plate that we're dealing with, especially if you have children. And how do we carve out that time for creativity? And basically, you were saying that, you know, it's something that it's not necessarily easy to find that time.
Right.
And also being in that creative place, because sometimes you might have the time, but you're not being creative and feeling creative. And I was wondering if you have any specific reflections what you might do for when you ever have writer's block or releasing writer's block.
I mean, I can say what works for me. I mean, because we teach this in our classes, ways around it, because I also coached so many authors and I see a lot of different kinds of personalities. So there's what works for me, which I know is not what works for everyone. Like for instance, I know that for me, if I have writer's block, the best thing I can do is sit down and write anyway. Yeah. And for some people, I know that that is like banging their head against a computer will make them feel badly about themselves. And what they really need to do is get up and go take a walk and breathe and be out in nature and get some distance. But for me, I know that just because of my personality, I have to push through it. I need to write through it. And even if I have, you know, a shitty whole page of writing, that at some point it's going to start to coalesce and make sense to me. And then I start to feel that like teeming, tingling energy that I get when I know it's working. And I blog a lot. And so I write all the time. And I get into that groove, and there is a real energetic feeling that I know when it's starting to come together. But when it's not, it's frustrating, but if I were to walk away in that moment, I would never get anything done.
I think so much of it can be, like you said, sort of staying with it and what I often do, and I'm sure you've done this yourself and even with teaching, but when we sit down and say we give a prompt and we're writing from a prompt, and that, you know, stream of consciousness writing, and then there might be this, that block immediately there. And I always say, give that guideline of, if you don't know what to write, just write, I don't know what to write.
Right.
And writing, I don't know what to write, because something inevitably will come. And what you were saying is to sort of sit, your practice is to sit down and work through it. And we do, I think we all have different ways of how we do that. You know, sometimes I will go for a walk in nature and just go, that's what I really need to do right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the other morning, I had a great morning of, I wrote 2,000 words, and then I got up and made a cup of tea and went back, and I was like, I think I can write some more. And I wrote another 1,000 words. Now, what I feel of those 3,000 words would be published or publishable to me, I'd be, there might be two paragraphs, there might be three, but it was, it's just the actual exercise of sitting down and writing.
Right.
And when I first work with being a coach with a, you know, a coaching client, and they might say to me, so what do you think, you know, where I should go? What's the structure? You know, what should I do right now? At the beginning, I'm very much about write. At this, mm-hmm. at this stage, just write, and write as much as you can. And when there's often that feedback of, just from people in general, writers in general, especially maybe people who are new to the craft of really making it a discipline of, I don't have enough time.
Mm-hmm.
I always say it's amazing how much you can write in 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so being in that practice of, I'm trying to sort of, you know, I keep a notebook like all around the house, and,
right.
and then remembering to have one in the car and just going, oh, I have this idea. And then, you know, writing it down. And then from that idea, how can we sort of jump from that and right. expand it into a piece? And that we don't necessarily have to think, oh, this is going to be a published book in the end.
Right.
But I'll have something. So I'm really interested in what your background and how you got to this place of having a publishing company and doing the work that you do, because I feel that it takes a lot to sort of formulate that together. So I'm sure the viewers would like to know, and I have a curiosity.
Right. I spent the longest portion of my career at Seal Press, which is a women's press, and it was a very foundational for me because I started working there when I was 28 years old, and I was there for over 8 years. And so just that time of my life, so much about working with women that was inspiring to me, coming into my own understanding of feminism and what feminism was and just feminist voices and working exclusively with women and how empowering and necessary that work was. And also that is coupled with my disillusion of the traditional publishing industry. And so there's like this incredible upward inspiring energy that came from that work. And then also very much at the same time feeling increasingly frustrated with how the traditional system works. And over the course of my time there, we were acquired by a corporate company. So I've been in publishing since 2000. So I came into publishing when I was just 23, and it was my first job, first career. And I had this long career, 13 plus years in traditional publishing. And I really just saw this opportunity to do something different. And this was, I think, inspired by my work with authors who I was coaching, who were telling me, I don't want to traditionally publish. I'm not interested in traditional publishing. And I was like shocked. Like, what? How could you not be interested in traditional publishing? What else is there? And then, so of course, during this time of the 2000s, you know, this whole time period when I was so deeply involved in traditional publishing, self-publishing was exploding. And so I just happened to be, I think, in the right place at the right time and have the right kind of openness and curiosity, seeing these books that my self-published authors were working on that were as good as traditionally published books, rejecting books at Seal that were better than books we were accepting. You know, that was another real mind screw for me because I was frustrated by that. Like, accepting a book based on an author platform and rejecting a beautifully written book because the author had no author platform and feeling very conflicted. So all of that meshed together for me to found She Writes Press with Kami, because Kami already had SheWrites.com. We had a very similar synergy. She was working with women. She had this platform. I came to her with the idea for the press and she was excited about it. So it just really happened organically, and it was all, it's been, you know, certainly not easy every step of the way, but it's just each next step has been the right step. And then when I left Seal, I partnered with Linda Joy in memoir because I didn't want to lose that. You know, I wanted to stay engaged with memoir, and that whole thing that we've been doing together of teaching memoir has come up alongside She Writes Press. I mean, it's a completely separate entity, but that has its own life force and its own stuff. And it's very synergistic. You know, there's nothing about it that feels like not connected in terms of like a mosaic, but, as She Writes Press has grown, so has my work as a teacher and a coach.
Thank you for answering that and giving the viewers and me more of an insight into your background, and also really addressing when you said that you worked at Seal Press and then it was bought, you know, taken over by a larger corporation. And I remember talking to the chair of the program, the graduate program that I was in, Writing and Consciousness at California Institute of Integral Studies. And Carolyn Cook is the chair of the program and she's published. And I remember having this conversation about the book. I think it was Queen Sugar.
Right, Natalie Bazile's book. Mm-hmm.
And Natalie came to the college one evening and I actually met her and talked with her. She read from her book and it was before it, you know, was Oprah took it on. I don't watch TV, but I know that that's happened. And, but I think it was, yeah, it was Carolyn. And I said, oh, you know, who was the publisher? And Carolyn said, well, it was so-and-so, but who's really so-and-so. And basically that's like, it's like two publishing companies now.
Right.
In terms of the major, you know, publishing companies. So it seems like so many of the smaller companies are really subsidiaries of the big companies. And that's one reason that I feel your work and your publishing company is so important, to still have these smaller publishing companies where I would imagine that as an author that comes to you and then is working with you, that it's really sort of more of a one-on-one experience, that you're, you know, you're not sort of being at this corporation, you know, sort of, oh, now I have to go to the media department and talk to the media department, and now I have to go and like talk to the lawyers about the publishing, you know.
Right.
And so I would imagine that that's such, you know, much more of an intimate experience for the authors that you publish.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is. And I'm sure there are pros and cons to that. Right. I think, we are small and it's a small staff. And so there's more intimacy. There's more hand holding. The upside maybe of those bigger publishing companies is their resources. But the problem of big publishing is that if they have the resources, they're allocating those resources to a small group of their authors. and then they don't tell the authors who's getting what resources. And so what ends up happening is that a lot of authors might, they might get a book deal from a big house, but then they feel very marginalized. And what they're not totally privy to is the fact that most of the resources are going to the A-level authors, and everyone else is just kind of on that list because what if they might be successful, but then they don't feel very supported. And our press definitely is more of a democracy. We're not selecting out these A-listers. We're basically saying everybody is on a level playing field, and you know, some of them rise to the top for any number of reasons, whether it's because of their writing or their story or their publicity plan. But everybody starts in the same place, and certainly from where they stand with me as the publisher, they stand in the same place. And I think that's unique in publishing, because publishing is a very celebrity-driven industry, just like music and film. And so they like to pretend that they're not, you know, that it's all about the literature, but it's not. It's all about celebrity and author platform, and increasingly more so. And so if you're not a celebrity and you just have a good book, you might get treated really well at a big house, or you might be very marginalized and lost.
Well, I know a little about that, maybe more than a little, just with my background being in the music industry.
Right.
So we, in England, my band was known as the best known unknown band, which is, you know, that was, and we had a top 40 hit, and we were signed to major record labels. You know, we were signed to CBS and Warner Brothers and RCA. However, very similar to what you're saying, it's like, you know, they had their top acts.
Right.
And that's where, you know, most of the money was being pushed towards, you know, most of the budget for promotions, et cetera, et cetera. But recently I was in the local bookstore and I was looking at new books, specifically memoir. And what I saw, it's sort of like, you know, you're going into your health food store and say Whole Foods, you know.
Right.
That you'll see foods particularly promoted. You know, they're sort of promoting one thing, whether it's on sale, etc. But in the bookstore, it's like you have the books that are really on the prime eye level as you go in. And then going through the actual shelves, I just was taking books out one by one and looking at them and reading the sleeves. And just feeling this almost like a heartache of all these authors that had been published. You know, they'd worked hard, they'd written their book, they'd worked hard to get a publishing contract. And these books are sort of pushed into the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And unless, I mean, I was in there probably 2 hours, you know, I gave myself an afternoon off one day to really, you know, I want to see what's out there. You know, you can get so much information on Amazon if you want to. But I'm the type of person, I have to go down. I have to have that book in my hand.
Right.
You know, I just, that's the way that I am. And I'm a visual learner. And it was just this, like, wow, you could have your book published and it doesn't even get the attention that it deserves.
Right.
So on hearing that you were saying that with your publishing company, it really does sound like a democracy, that you're not going to treat someone, you know, this author, you know, as the celebrity author over this author. And I also really believe that with my, you know, my background and in activism and feminism, that it is really important to have a publishing company just for women authors.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, it's very important. And just to, you know, we have a few minutes left, and just to, I don't want to say finalize, but we are going to bring our conversation to a close. And I'd love to hear a few words from you on why you feel that it's important to have a publishing company for women.
There are so many reasons, and when I worked at Seal Press, you know, I just got the job. It wasn't my idea to found a women's press when I started working there. And I realized over the course of my time there how important it was, how important it is to have women-only spaces. The publishing world is still very skewed toward men. The people at the top of publishing companies are still largely male. You know, so you have a female-dominated industry with men at the top. And it also caters to men. Men win more prizes. Men are more likely to be published, even though more women read books. I personally know people who have been asked to change their protagonist to a male protagonist when the person was a woman protagonist. You know, there's just a lot of ingrained patriarchy, and people, I mean, I think what's interesting about Trump in the election is that it's really risen to the top. I think it's shocking how much patriarchy is dominating our culture in a way that, of course, feminists have seen, but I don't think people who were not paying attention could quite see how much we're run by a male system. And so women and feminists have been fighting against that for years and years. And within the context of a female publishing company, we're fighting against that too. You know, fighting in for a space for women's voices to be part of the norm. You know, I think normalizing women in leadership roles, normalizing women as protagonists and people who deserve to have their stories heard in all kinds of capacities. And when there's no competition against men in a women-only space, those voices then can be heard in all kinds of nuanced variations. And I think it's hugely important, and it's important, you know, to model for our children. And I have a son, you know, so I think I want a world where he thinks, I wanted a woman president because I wanted a world where he would be like, yeah, a woman can be president. You know, those kinds of things matter to me as a woman and as a mother and as a feminist. So for all of those reasons, I think the work we're doing is really, really important. And I really appreciate it when men are like, I get it. That's awesome. You know, good for you. Because unfortunately, a lot of men don't feel that way. They don't get why we need a women's press, or sometimes they're resentful or angry or just kind of ticked off about it. But more often than not, I find that men are really supportive, and I am deeply grateful.
Yeah. I overall have that experience of men who are supportive. And as you say, I think with the Trump administration, really what it's done is really expose what's always been there.
Right, exactly.
And we would sort of, you know, so many people, we were just in this sort of cloud that things had changed, especially because, you know, we had a president who happened to have black skin. And then we thought, oh, so we don't have racism. Of course we don't have racism if we have a black president. And it would be the same if we had a woman president. You know, we can't say that sexism and discrimination and all of that has been ruled out. So I want to personally thank you for having a publishing company for women and run by women. And I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak to me and for our viewers today. And it's a lot of information, and I really want to encourage people to look at your website, and we'll have it all written up so that it's very clear that people can see it, and there'll be an easy link for people to come over to see this work that you do, and especially for people who are working on memoirs to come over and connect with you and see if they feel that you'd be a good fit. And from watching your videos, and also I haven't interviewed Linda Joy yet. We were setting that up, but we had a great phone conversation. And speaking to the two of you, I, as a writer and a memoir writer, would feel really confident to put myself in your hands. And also that I would feel that I know that you would be honest with me, and I feel that you would be a coach who would be holding my feet to the fire.
Right. All of those things.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and it's, I know that it's what I need is to have my feet, you know, held to the fire of completing the project, but also to have that reflection on my writing. And for writers, that it's so important to have that outside. And as you said, that if you felt that there was, that someone was taking your advice, but then saying, no, I don't want to do this. But if it was sort of a constant thing, that maybe that isn't the right person for you to work with on either side. But it, I do feel that it's really important to have a coach that you will, that the writer, the author will be coachable to actually listen, because it's so important to have the outside voice.
Right.
And the outside voice in that supportive environment. And going back to what you said of the emotions, you know, the emotionality that will, can come up and will come up. And right. you, as you are really becoming authentic. And I do think that that's what, not that we should necessarily be writing for the audience by thinking, oh, I'm writing this book in a specific way for, because I think the audience will be interested in this. But where the interest, I believe, it comes from is when we are truly in our authentic, raw voices. And as you said much earlier in the interview, that what you write, it doesn't necessarily mean that what I email you right now is going to be published on the page.
Right.
But just to write it.
Right.
So thank you so much for what you do and your time. It's been really great talking to you. And
thank you.
I'll be following up with you.